Okay, I'm going to assume that we're on, so let's go ahead and begin. This morning is wall-to-wall annual improvements. We'll start with Denise. We're going to do Denise's two papers together so that we don't subject her to hanging around in the middle. Mm-hmm. So Denise, I guess we start on 17A.
Yes, thank you, Wayne. The ISB published its exposure draft on annual improvements in IFRS's 2012-2014 cycle in December 2013. This exposure draft includes a collection of five amendments to four standards. The comment period ended on the 13th of March 2014, and the ISB received 64 comment letters. Agenda papers 17A to 17E provide an analysis of the comment letters received on these proposed amendments. So I'm going to start with agenda paper 17A, which analyzes an amendment on IFRS 5, changes in methods of disposal. So this paper includes an analysis of the comment letters received on the proposal to amend IFRS 5. This amendment originally clarified the accounting for a change in a disposal plan from held for sale to held for distribution, and also provides guidance in IFRS 5 for the discontinuation of held for distribution accounting. There was general support on the proposed amendment, but half of the respondents asked the Interpretations Committee to provide some further clarification on some topics. First of all, whether the date of classification of a sale changes when there is a change from held for sale to held for distribution. They also ask for more clarification on the accounting for the difference that may exist between fair value less cost to sale and fair value less cost to distribute, and also to clarify the meaning of a direct reclassification from held for sale or held for distribution. We agreed that these points raised could be further clarified, and we made some changes to the drafting of the proposed amendment. The respondents also recommended to the ISB that it should include other references to help for distribution or cost to distribute. And we disagree with this proposal because we think that IFRS 5 includes a general instruction that the requirements in IFRS 5 for help for sale also apply for help for distribution. So having addressed the comments raised, we think that the Interpretations Committee should recommend the ISB to proceed with this proposed amendment to IFRS 5. And we are asking two questions to the Interpretations Committee, whether you agree with our analysis and also with the drafting of the proposed amendments as shown in Agenda Paper 17A, little I. Thank you.
Comments? Going once, going twice, Florence.
The paper touches on one real question, which is whether a change triggers re-initialization of the date of classification as held for sale. And this triggers the question about initially how many details are expected in a plan in classification as held for sale, whether it is just plan to disposal regardless of whether it's by sale or through distribution. And because here there is a focus on direct, which is explaining the basis for conclusion. But I'm not sure that it is all the time sufficiently clear in the amendment itself. This thing.
I'm not sure I understand what you're driving at, Laurence. Can you fill it out a little more?
There will be questions about such change, whether they change the date of classification for the extension and how much you can prolong, not prolong. And I understand that this clarification is provided in the basis.
I see. Okay.
For conclusion, it's not in the standard itself.
So you'd prefer to see it in the standard?
Undoubtedly, we'll have questions. Whether was it needed that it is documented up front that the disposal could take place either by sale or distribution, or if you have written that it, you expect to dispose by sale and then you change your view and finally because it doesn't work, then you go and for distribution, this affects the date for initial classification, determining how long the 1 year flows or not. These are the real questions.
You raise a fair question, and I think how we saw it was there is some specific guidance about when you do have an extension, so some guidance as to when you get an extension to that year. We also clarified in response to one of the other issues raised about the need for it to be a sort of a continuous sort of qualification in order to reclassify from one to the other without stopping. And so we felt that those two factors together sort of led us to conclude that the guidance is already there in terms of this is how it applies, and hence the explanation in the basis. But I guess you're questioning whether that's explicit enough, whether we need to be explicit in the standard itself.
Are you referring specifically to the explanations we've got in paragraph BC72K in page 5? Yes, sorry, in 17AI in paragraph BC72K. When we say the determination of the 12-month period should not restart when such change in method of disposal occurs.
So that answers your concern?
Because, you see, we've got the general principle in paragraph 26D in the main guidance. We're saying that the date of classification, that the reclassification from held for sale to held for distribution does not change the date of classification in accordance with paragraphs 8 and 12A. So that's the current guidance in IFRS 5. We are just confirming that when this change occurs, the date of classification does not change. And yeah, the explanations on the basis, they are just a little bit clarifying what that means.
While Laurence looks at that, let's go to John.
Just one. I agree with the amendments, but in direct reclassification, in actually explaining direct reclassification in BC72I, it sort of explained that you move from one method of disposal to the other without any significant time lag, so that there is no interruption. Well, it seems to me that those are no significant time lag means there can be a time lag, but with no interruption, so therefore there is no time lag. So I'm not quite sure I understand whether there's allowed to be a time lag or you have to continuously meet the criteria. I would have thought you have to continuously meet the criteria, and therefore the issue is no time lag. It's actually a continuous meeting of the criteria. So it seems to me it's ambiguous as to whether you're allowed to have a time lag or not in BC72I.
So we cut out no significant.
Yes. Okay.
Staff, we accept that. Any others? Okay, Laurence is still pondering. Denise, can you sit down with Laurence after the meeting? And the two of you make sure that... Tom?
Yes, thank you. It's about the... prospective versus the retrospective application. According to the staff analysis, if I understood it well, it is said that because IFRIC 17 has a prospective application, we now propose to do it here as well. But the reasons in IFRIC 17 were the possible use of hindsight. When you look to this amendment, we are not sure that the use of hindsight would be a problem. So we were a little bit surprised about the rationale for not requiring a retrospective application of this amendment.
It's just the way we saw it is that these amendments to IFRS 5 should have been amended by IFRIC 17, and we just follow the same application of the requirements. I understand what you're saying. That was the logic we used to require prospective application.
We would have preferred to have the retrospective application, and if you say, okay, we it might be better somewhere, or that kind of reasons for accepting prospective application, then it would be better to reflect that in place. Because the risk of use of hindsight
to this. Others on the transition? John?
I think the difficulty might be you would have to look back as to whether you did meet the criteria on a continuous basis, and the criteria are fairly judgmental, so it seems to me you would be, there's a danger of using hindsight as to whether you met the criteria on a continuous basis. If you try to apply this retrospectively. So, because if somebody had considered the change to be a change and had stopped, gone out of IFRS 5 and then come back in, what this would say is they should have been continuous. But of course, they can only be continuous if they met the criteria.
That would have been my reaction to it, that this is one of those that's best left to perspective. It's a judgment call. Other comments? General support then for going to the board with this? Heads nodding yes for those of you who don't have video. Okay, that's what we'll do. Next up, we're going to jump to 17E, I guess.
Yes, I'm going to move on to 17 paper 17E. This paper includes an analysis of the comment letters received on the proposal to amend IS 34. This amendment clarifies the meaning of disclosure of information elsewhere in the financial report and requires inclusion of a cross-reference from the interim financial statements to the location of this information. One-third of the respondents agreed with the proposed amendment, but the other two-thirds of the respondents conditionally agree or disagreed with the proposed amendments. So among the concerns raised are that the proposed amendment is not necessary and or is too broad. We disagreed with these comments because we think that the amendment is sufficiently narrow and the amendment is needed to eliminate some ambiguity that exists in determining whether some information can be presented or not outside the financial statements. Some respondents also thought that the ISB should clarify the meaning of interim financial report. And also in the drafting of paragraph 16A, they asked the ISB to clarify the meaning of the phrase on the same terms as the interim financial statements and at the same time. In this respect, we thought that the meaning of on the same terms could be further clarified as on the same basis as the financial statements. You have seen the analysis of the paper. So having addressed the concerns raised, we think that the Interpretations Committee should recommend the ISB to proceed with this proposed amendment to IS 34. And again, we're asking if you agree with the analysis we made and also with the proposed amendments as shown in Agenda Paper 17E, little I. Do you have any comments?
Comments? Reinhardt?
The one question I had was in the proposed amendment to paragraph 16A, the second to last sentence says, if users do not have access to the information incorporated by reference, the interim financial report is incomplete. I would have thought it's the interim financial statements are incomplete as opposed to the interim financial report. Because it's incorporating by reference information elsewhere, outside.
The way I understand this amendment is that, well, this proposal is that we are confirming the fact that notes to the financial statements can be presented outside the financial, outside the interim financial report, or outside the financial statements. So if you see the definition of interim financial report is includes the financial statements and the notes. So what I'm saying is that if you do not take into account those notes, then the interim financial report will be incomplete. I think your point is very valid. It's also the financial statements, but the complete set that comprises the interim financial report would also be incomplete.
I think what Reinhardt is saying is that we traditionally say the financial statements includes the four major statements and the notes. You can't have just one or just the other. So the word report, you've changed it to statements otherwise. Why don't we just use the word statements consistently with the traditional use of the term?
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Okay, that's accepted.
Then financial statements. And that's what I thought. That's how I read the English. And so the financial statements could be complete, but the financial report might not be. And so stuff can be outside the financial statements and in the financial report. It sounded okay to me, that's what I'm saying.
As defined, 934, the interim financial report is comprised by the financial statements and the notes.
Yeah. So that's how I read it. Is it read, or else I'm saying, is it read okay before?
But if the users don't have that information that's incorporated outside of the financial statements,
then the statements are incomplete. That's what Reinhardt is saying.
Right.
Okay.
John?
I was just going to say, I thought it read okay, because the requirement in for the minimum components is of an interim financial report. So the requirement in 34 is around the actual contents of the report, not the statements. So it seemed to me that it's a completeness of the report. So I thought the staff wording was appropriate. So.
How many like report? How many like statements? How many don't care? Statements wins. Okay. Others, Julie?
Well, I was going to come in on that, but maybe it's too late. I was just going to say, aren't both cases true? I mean, if people don't have access, then both the financial statements and the report are incomplete.
Well, if they don't have access, the statements are incomplete, and our standards are about the statements. So it seems to me that what's provided in supplementary information may be complete or incomplete, but...
Yeah, with respect to your standards and statements, but it's a point of fact that if they don't have access, then the report may be incomplete. I mean, I don't think that's an untrue statement.
No, it's just outside the scope.
If the statements are incomplete, then
the report is incomplete, even if there's no other problem with the report.
Right, that was my comment. Both are really true. It's just a question of which you want to say.
And 34 is about... It says report comprises... It's sort of the way we express an IS-1. One says the financial statements are the primary statements plus the notes, and then the 34 says a financial report is the primary statements plus the notes.
Yeah, so it's an old standard. Laurence, I hit your button. Did you want to come in, or?
Yeah, two comments. The first one pointing at IS-34, which refers at interim financial report being either a complete set of financial statements or condensed financial statements, and nowhere in IS-34 they refer to interim financial statements. There is no such thing referred to in IS-34. Just want to point that out. The second comment is that by making that amendment, this is going to create complexity for users to understand the level of assurance that will be provided to the data that is not included in the complete set of financial statements or the condensed financial statements. I just want to report that thing and for the users to highlight that.
That's inherent in cross-referencing out, isn't it? Scott, did you want to come in again?
I was just going to say that, you know, that I would have thought that the cross-reference in the statements would have made clear that whatever level of assurance applies to the statements includes that cross-reference, and therefore it's drawn in. And the other thing I would say is, while I think when we set standards, we need to realize that others will require levels of assurance applied to different pieces of the standards, that's not really our
precisely
our call. So if a regulator wants to say that cross-referenced information does not need to be covered by the report on the interim financials, that's up to the regulator. And we ought not set standards for reporting based on what we hope regulators do with regards to required assurance.
Recognize, but we ought to be cognizant of
sure.
If we create problems for auditors and regulators, we ought to know about it. Tony?
I was going to say, much the same as Laurence, about the words in IAS 34 and how they translate into the amendment, in that the IAS 34 doesn't say interim financial statements anywhere, it just says condensed or interim financial report.
It says interim financial statements in paragraph 16A.
The definitions and the contents of the...
Well,
the,
not the definitions.
Yeah.
I was just following the and same I, wording. But
my point was maybe a broader one as to whether what we're doing is clear, and I support it, and I think it's helpful. It's just whether having two or three or whatever terms for the same thing
that was
actually helpful, and whether there's just an opportunity here to tidy that up and maybe use the same expression all the way. And I don't know if that's going beyond the scope of what we're trying to do or it's too broad, but I just think one of the tensions is using different words for the same thing. And we could end up, I think people could end up reading it to say, well, there's interim financial statements, there's an interim report, there's condensed financial statements. Are they all the same thing? Are they different? And I just wondered if there was an opportunity to tidy all that up as part of doing this.
Having not exposed tidying all that.
I understand that maybe that's something that is a step too far, but it was a thought that we're using different words, or the standard uses different words.
It would be handy to clean up. There are lots of things in IAS 34 to clean up, though, so...
There are principles that could be cleaned up. Yeah. That's obviously where you are. I was thinking this is just a question of the words.
Okay. Andrew?
Similar comments to Tony's. I do think IAS 34 uses the terms interim financial report and interim financial statements somewhat interchangeably. But it does seem to envisage that the interim report might be a larger thing which includes financial statements plus some other commentary and analysis. And this amendment is just saying there's some flexibility on where within that wider report you locate particular disclosures subject to ease of access and cross-referencing requirements. So I think we're going to move forward. We should avoid trying to broaden it out into sorting out the wider interchangeability of language and just confirm the flexibility that exists and the conditions around that flexibility on location.
I was with Reinhardt initially. I think I've reached the point of not caring. Let's ask again. Report?
Who favors it?
Eight.
Okay, we're back to report. Signee date. Or however pronounced it's pronounced. Any other comments? Oh, Tom?
We can accept the solution for the short term to say okay, cross references for all those disclosures. We were a little bit surprised about paragraph 21, where it states that staff observes that only the disclosures in paragraph 16A, A till K of IAS 34 can be provided. There are a lot of disclosures, and we are not sure that it is in the interest of transparency to have all kind of references to other parts of the document. So we would prefer for the longer term an alignment between IAS 1, where only IFRS 7 is allowed to do outside the financial statements, and IAS 34.
Okay, point taken. Mm-hmm. Okay, I see nobody else who wants to weigh in. General support for taking this to the board? Okay. Okay, that brings us to 17B. No.
Yes.
Brings us.
Yeah, 17B.
Okay.
Morning. Agenda paper 17B shows our analysis on the comment letters received on the proposed amendments to IFRS 7 for the issue related to servicing contracts. Agenda paper 17BI presents a staff draft of the proposed amendment to IFRS 7 that is derived from our analysis in agenda paper 17B. The exposure draft included the proposed guidance that would clarify how the guidance in paragraph 42C of IFRS 7 should be applied to servicing contracts to decide whether servicing contracts are continuing involvement for the purposes of the transfer disclosure requirements. And it also proposed a transition relief, that is, an entity does not need to apply the amendment to comparative periods. For question one, which is about the body of the amendments to IFRS 7, 53 respondents provided comments for this specific issue. About two-thirds of the respondents agree with little or no further comment, and one-third of the respondents agree with the amendment subject to further considerations, and one respondent disagreed with the amendment. And one of the major comments we received is about the lack of principles in the proposed guidance. In particular, some respondents suggested that ISB should delete the presumption that the right to receive a servicing fee is generally continuing involvement. We agree with that suggestion because the intention of this amendment was to clarify that an entity should assess the servicing contracts against the disclusion of continuing involvement in paragraph 42C and B30. So we propose to delete the presumption from the proposed guidance in paragraph B30A. And some respondents expressed concerns over the usefulness of the transfer disclosures of servicing contracts. They argued that the risk profile of a servicing contract is different from other financial instruments that constitute continuing involvement, and applying the existing disclosure requirements to a servicing contract would not provide useful information to users. Furthermore, one respondent asks for clarification about the application of some specific disclosure requirements in respect of servicing contracts. However, we think that the discussions of the usefulness of the transfer disclosure requirements and providing detailed guidance for the transfer disclosures are beyond the scope of this project, because the amendment intends to just clarify how the guidance in paragraph 42C should apply to servicing contracts. So we think that no further consideration is necessary for the transfer disclosure requirements. And when it comes to question two, which is about the transition requirements and the effective date, 39 respondents expressed their views on this specific amendment. And most of those respondents agree with the transition provision that an entity need not apply the amendment to comparative periods. So we think that the transition requirements in the exposure draft should be retained. And our questions are, does the committee agree to recommend to the ISB that it should proceed with amendments to IFRS 7 with the revisions to the amendments that were described in this agenda paper? And if so, does the committee have any comment on the staff draft of the proposed amendment in agenda paper 70BI?
Comments and questions? Going once. Twice. Reinhardt.
I thought I would just note for the record, I understand the logic as to why disclosures weren't reconsidered in the context of servicing contracts, but the existing disclosures in IFRS 7 don't fit neatly with the nature of a servicing contract. And so my fear is that as a consequence, there will be some fair diversity in practice when people provide the disclosures. I mean, there's nothing to prevent, obviously, people from providing more disclosures or disclosures I think that are relevant, but in terms of meeting the minimum, some of those required minimum disclosures don't fit neatly with the type of risks and the risk profile of a servicing contract. And so, as I say, I fear there will be diversity.
Others? Philippe?
Maybe a stupid question. This precision that we give about the continuing involvement has two consequences, one about disclosures, but also one about the accounting, the retention on the books or taking off the books. No? So if we make it more specific or if we give more guidance on how to analyze involvement, continuing involvement, it has consequences also, I suppose, for the accounting and not only for disclosures. Am I right?
Yeah, I'm seeing head shaking. No, Laurent.
No, okay, maybe I'm wrong. Yeah.
This has been part of the concerns expressed by constituents that the words continuing involvement don't have the same meaning under IS 39 and IFRS 7. Right. And this is not acknowledged anywhere, except in the staff paper, where the staff paper says it's too broad to address.
I think we hit
but
that.
I think it would be helpful to have this acknowledgement somewhere that assessment of what is continuing involvement is not the same exercise, depending on whether you're assessing continuing involvement for the purpose of derecognition and IS 39, or whether you assess continuing involvement for the purpose of disclosures under IFRS 7.
I remember stumbling over Philippe's point myself when we brought this issue. And that was the response I got, was it's a different test, but it's valid to say we ought to include it in the basis at least.
Yeah. Yeah. In the amendment itself, we're very careful to make sure that we say continued involvement for the purposes of the disclosures,
right.
But
it
we
would
could
be useful
add it
to
also
acknowledge
also
it.
Explain
yeah.
it in
yeah.
the basis.
Because even if we add for the purpose of disclosures, we start with the same words. And logically, the same words should lead to the same conclusions. So if we cannot find different words, maybe we should be very specific and explain in the basis for conclusions a bit more this notion of for the purpose of and explain that it has different consequences for disclosures and for accounting.
Yeah. Laurent, you wanted to come in again and then we'll get Martin. No, Laurent is okay. Martin?
Probably just because of the wording, if you don't want to say continuing involvement, probably continuing servicing or something like this, when we really say, okay, we have one which is a continuing involvement, which has a completely other meaning than continuing servicing or something like this, because we are talking here about services.
But the language of 7 talks about, for better or worse, continuing involvement. So if we say now continuing servicing, we've introduced a whole new word. I understand your point, but that would have been better done when they drafted 7.
Okay.
But they didn't. So hindsight is always 20/20. Other comments? Goes to the board. Head shaking around the room. No head shaking the other direction. We'll go. Okay, that leaves us with C&D and Leo. Leo has left the... No, Leo is in the stadium. C&D, excuse me, I misspoke.
Thank you. Good morning. Agenda paper 17C provides an analysis of the comment letter received on the proposed amendment to paragraph 44R of IFRS 7. The proposal clarifies that the offsetting disclosure required by IFRS 7 are not specifically required for all interim periods, These disclosures are given in condensed interim financial statement prepared in accordance with IAS 34 only when they are required by IAS 34. We received very few comments on this proposal, and almost all the respondents agreed with the proposal. One respondent suggested deleting the last sentence of paragraph BC7 of the exposure draft, because this sentence could be read as implying a level of disclosure almost as extensive as that required in annual financial statements. The sentence is reproduced in paragraph 17 of the paper. We agree with their comment, so we propose deleting the last sentence of paragraph BC7 of the exposure draft. On the basis of the comment received, we think that the proposed amendment to paragraph 44R of FRS 7 should be finalized. So we ask the committee member whether they agree to recommend to the ASB to finalize the amendment and whether they agree to delete the last sentence of paragraph BC7 of the exposure draft. Thank you.
Comments? Morantz?
It's a general issue about to what extent you need to give those new disclosures in the first interim reports that follows introduction of a new standard. And I see that the staff is proposing that this comment is broad. I agree it's broad and will be reported to the ISB. But maybe I have a question to Alan about how he thinks this type of issue might be addressed and when. And
over to you, Alan.
It's a horrible question. We actually, within the scope of the Disclosure Initiative, have a project called Principles of Disclosure, and one of the issues there is interim financial statements, partly because the one thing that we debate significantly, particularly with the US, is the level of detail, because they have a different model to us. And so we end up with slightly different, quite strong arguments, and I think in some cases possibly more going into the interims than we intended or would have had outside of a joint project. However, if you ask our board members to go around the room, you'll get, in fact, I know of one board member in here who thinks very strongly that it's a very important issue, and then others think this will just delay everything. So what we're planning to do is we actually have a standard setter that we're negotiating with who's going to do some work for us, but it's going to be, you're talking about 2 to 3 years or so, I would have thought, and that's going to be more of a think pieces about how we approach interim reports.
Okay. Andrew?
I agree with the amendment. Just for the record, we did suggest in our comment letter that companies should be able to early apply this amendment independently of the 17B amendment, and the staff comment was that might cause confusion to users. I just want to come back briefly on that, because this amendment is basically providing relief or clarification that offsetting disclosures needn't be provided in interim financial statements. The other amendment is potentially adding to the volume of continuing involvement disclosures in annual financial statements, so I'm not entirely convinced that adopting this one before the 17B amendment would cause any confusion to anyone, but not a big deal, but I wanted to restate the point.
I take your point. We usually, and there are always exceptions, say you got to do everything all at once. That if we've got two amendments to the same standard, we make them, you have to apply them at the same way. Now, I can think of a couple of exceptions to that. But other comments on Andrew's point?
If I could just say, we want to try and, as we're making sort of annual improvements and narrow scope amendments, try and consolidate changes so that there aren't so many different changes potentially happening at different times for different companies depending on what they choose to early apply. So that's the thought process behind these comments. When it comes to annual improvements though, sometimes they're about changing the requirements, but sometimes they're about clarifying the requirements. So clearly those that are about clarifying the requirements, if it's a case of there are currently two different ways in which people are in good faith reading the standard and we're clarifying to say it's one way only, that's not to say that those who are reading it the other way are, you know, doing something wrong. Yes, they might need to change when the effective date comes in, but I suppose there's a degree of latitude there in terms of your ability to read the current words
in a reasonable way. Okay. Other, excuse me. So we leave it as is, unless there are others that. Okay, support for taking it to the board. Heads nodding up and down, no head shaking, we go. Seventeen D, Leo?
Yes. Agenda paper 17D provides an analysis of the comment letter received on the proposed amendment to paragraph 83 of IS 19. The proposal clarifies that the depth of the market for high-quality corporate bonds should be assessed at the currency level. 58 respondents commented on this proposal, and many of them have a concern about the proposed amendment. Some respondents asked to clarify whether the proposed amendment prohibits an entity that operates in a country when there is a deep market for high-quality corporate bonds from using only the high-quality corporate bonds issued in its country. In our view, the proposal allows to use only the high-quality corporate bonds issued in a country because it does not provide guidance on this topic. Some respondents asked the ISB to clarify which government bond should be used if the market for high-quality corporate bonds is not deep. In our view, the proposal should not specify which government bonds should be used because this is outside of the scope of the amendment. Some respondents asked the ISB to clarify whether the proposed amendments also apply when a currency is pegged to another currency. In our view, a pegged currency is another currency that should be continued to be viewed as separate from the currency to which it's pegged. Some respondents have concern about the potential effects of the proposed amendment on countries that have adopted a stronger currency as their official currency, without being members of a regional market with a common currency. They think that the proposal could result in anomalous outcomes in these countries, because a discount rate determined from high-quality corporate bonds denominated in a strong currency could be inconsistent with the inflation rate and the other assumptions used in these countries to determine the cost of providing post-employment benefits. They note that according to paragraph 75 of IS 19, actuarial assumptions shall be mutually compatible. We agree with the concern about the potential effects on this proposed amendment in this country, so we think that an analysis of these effects should be done. Regarding the transitional provision, we agree that for some entities, a full retrospective application of the proposal can be bothersome. Consequently, we recommend that the committee should wait for the analysis of the potential effect of the proposed amendment to IS 19 before recommending whether the ISB should proceed with the proposed amendment. We also recommend that if the committee decides to finalize the proposed amendment, we think that it should recommend that the amendment should be applied prospectively from the beginning of the earliest comparative period presented. In page 12 of the paper, we ask the committee members three questions. The first one is whether the committee agrees that it should wait for the analysis of the potential effect of the proposed amendment for the countries identified in paragraph 38 of the paper. The second one is whether the committee agrees that the effect analysis summarized in paragraph 38 and 39 of the paper, and if they have any comments on this effect analysis. The last one is whether the committee agrees that the amendment should be applied prospectively from the beginning of the earliest period presented. Thank you.
Okay, the first recommendation is that we should wait. Do you have any idea how long?
Until Leo's gone.
Well, that's the end of June, so.
That's all they care about.
I think the analysis will require some time. For this reason, we're asking the committee if they want that we do this analysis, because it's not easy, because speaking about countries that we don't have many contact in these countries. We're speaking about Zimbabwe, Panama, Ecuador.
Are we confident that the countries named in the paper are the complete list?
No.
No, okay. All right. Scott goes first, and then Laurence.
Kind of reflecting on what this annual improvement is trying to do. I think if I boil it down, it's trying to clarify that when selecting discount rates, we care about currency. While when IAS 19 was written, you could use currency and country interchangeably because each country had its own currency. So it you know, the mindset was not that there was a difference there. And I think what we're doing with this annual improvement is saying the important thing is currency, not country. If that's the case, I'm not sure what this additional study is going to tell us. I think we'll still come back with what we're worried about is the currency in which you have agreed to pay benefits. So I'm not sure it matters whether that currency is your country's currency, a regional market's currency, another country's currency, or bitcoins. You've made a promise denominated in some currency. And I think what we're saying in this annual improvement is the discount rate ought to be made with reference to that currency. That's what we're trying to clarify. Everything else, whether you're allowed to use high-quality corporate bonds issued only by your country if there happens to be a deep market, or how broad you need to go to look for, I mean, we're not addressing any of that. So I'm not sure the issues are any different when you're dealing with Ecuador that uses the U.S. dollar or Greece that uses the euro.
No, I agree. They're not any different, but I think people are saying we ought to think harder about it.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what is different about the thought process there. In both cases, the country itself does not control the currency because it's either a regional market or another country's currency. I don't see how you could really come up with different answers based on whether the currency you've pegged the promise to is another country's currency or a regional market's currency. How would that not be the same concerns? So, I mean, doing more work, well, okay, I mean, that's always advisable. More information is good. But I don't know to what end we are performing this work.
Leo?
Because at the moment we don't have many information about this country. At the moment I don't know how many entities in this country apply IFRS. I don't know if there are post-employment benefits in this country. We only received some letter that says to us, pay attention.
And again, I mean, you know, more information, excuse me, is always better than less information. But but again, Ecuador using the U.S. dollar seems to me to be in exactly the same position as Greece using the euro.
No.
But we don't think we need more information about Greece before reaching a consensus. So I'm just concerned that we're holding up the other guidance in this improvement, which I think is useful, to do research on something that, yeah, I think we've already concluded we know enough about in other situations that are the same.
John?
My reaction is exactly the same as Scott's. I mean, I don't know what an effects analysis is going to tell us other than that the IAS 19 discount rate has some problems with it, which I think we've been discussing for over 12 months. So, I mean, it seems to me that the issues of the currency, I mean, if your promise is you've made your promises in U.S. dollars, what's going to be a better, you know, what's the effect analysis going to tell us or point us to a better approach towards determining the discount rate that we don't already know? So I'm not convinced that the effects analysis is going to inform us any more on this issue than we already are. And I do agree with what Scott said. I think the issue is not just countries that are using different currencies and stronger currencies. There's regional, there's countries where the inflation, and we did touch on this last year when we were discussing the discount rate. There are different inflation assumptions in the Eurozone, but they're actually, we're looking to a Euro, discount rate. So it's exactly the same issue. I believe it's the same issue. The variation might be that there's more control in the Eurozone the members have over their currency than some of these, Panama and these countries, have over the currency they're using for these obligations. The other point is about the entities. I wasn't quite sure. We're talking about the effects analysis also being entities, referring not just to the countries, but entities in particular countries as well. I mean, it seems to me that doing an effects analysis by looking at the impact on entities is way too broad and beyond the scope of what we should be doing around an annual improvement. So.
Tony?
Very much the same position. I can't see what we're going to get out of an effects analysis. I think we knew when we recommended the annual improvement in the first place that by focusing on the currency as the principle, then that was inevitably going to mean in some cases that the assumptions wouldn't necessarily be compatible on a country by country level. That was the principle that we agreed. And I just can't see this being any different, whether it's a country that, or an entity that chooses to denominate its employee benefit obligation in another currency, or a country that's chosen to use another country's currency. I think the issues are the same, and I think there's a danger here that we're holding up what I think most people consider to be a step forward and some helpful guidance for a lot of people for a very narrow range of situations that we had already addressed. So I think I'd agree with John and Scott that I don't think there's any benefit coming out of the effects analysis.
Okay. Martin and then Andrew.
I agree with Scott and Tony. However, where I struggle a little bit is, imagine you have Ecuador and you might have no liquid market for high quality of corporate bonds. And then you have the fallback solution to take government bonds. And Ecuador then is issuing government bonds in US dollar. So what government bonds are you taking then? The government bonds only of Ecuador, or government bonds, say, well, all countries issuing government bonds in US dollar? I would assume then take the government bonds of Ecuador, but there we could really see a huge difference, because the credit risk of Ecuador and the US might be severely different.
What we say this amendment is around the currency to which you look to determine whether there is a deep market.
Yeah.
So once you've decided that your currency is the US dollar, then you're going to say, yes, there's a deep market. But what this amendment doesn't do is doesn't go any further. It doesn't tell you how to select your population of bonds. And I understand that some of the respondents seem to be confused about that, but I think it's perfectly clear. This is just telling you that you're using the currency to determine whether there is a deep market. It doesn't take the next step. And in my view, quite rightly, it doesn't take the next step. It also doesn't talk about what government bonds you use.
Yeah, the genesis of this issue,
I think, came from ESMA.
Yes.
And the genesis of this issue, correct me if I'm wrong, Don, was that we had people in the Eurozone arguing for one reason or another that they ought to revert to their local government bond, because they said in their locality there wasn't a deep market. And the answer was, well, no, there is a deep market in the Eurozone. And so I assume applying this, if you'd adopted the US dollar, and I was a little concerned about the use of the term stronger there, I think just different might have been better. But in any event, once you've selected another currency to both denominate and pay your benefits, the principle was you look to the market for bonds in that currency. So, okay, Andrew?
I hear what others have said so far. I'm actually with the staff on this. I'll be comfortable to wait for the effects analysis. In the discussions I think we've been having today, certainly in my own mind, I'd be thinking about the Eurozone and this issue, not really thinking about the implications for Ecuador Panama, El Salvador, and possibly etc. And I'd like a bit more information on understanding those implications before moving forward. I do think there is a difference between a currency union with a central bank and other financial mechanisms and the decision by one country to adopt another country's currency without any control over that currency. I'd like to understand those differences a bit better before moving forward. There's the discussion so far is, do you look at country or look at currency? And we seem to be saying, let's do one or the other and clarify which it is, but there is the potential that the right answer might depend on other factors. So I prefer to wait whilst hearing what others have said. Picking up on the staff paper in paragraph 14 and Tony's comments, I thought the amendment to the ED was a bit ambiguous as to whether it was just dealing with the assessment of the depth of market on a currency level rather than the population of high quality corporate bonds and which countries you derive those from in determining your discount rate. If we allow some disconnect between those two pieces of the process, that in effect means that we're using the word market in two different ways, more or less in the same paragraph. And I know we're dealing perhaps with an old and imperfect standard here, but I'm a little bit troubled by that potential disconnect.
Others share that view?
No.
Okay, no traction. What I propose that we do is, I believe, certainly a majority of those who have spoken supported moving forward. So, Andrew has expressed a reservation. Anybody else have a reservation? Just put your hand up. Kaz
and Reinhardt.
I propose then that we go forward, but that we inform the board very clearly.
Yeah, sure.
That this was an issue that was raised, that at least some members of the committee thought we should wait, so the board is fully informed when it makes its decision. Board members around the table, you think that would be useful?
Are you giving us a good effect analysis at that time?
No, no, we're not. We're suggesting you don't get an effect analysis.
So but there is some potential, some effects, unexpected effects on those countries might be. We need such information before making any decision. Maybe that would be a good idea for us to make a good decision.
Laurence, and then let's close the move on with the next points.
Perhaps in presenting the issue to the board, one thing that needs to be highlighted is that issue that popped up. Then if you focus on the currency and say, yeah, look at everything, it's the interaction between selecting the population of the bonds in that currency and mutually compatible assumptions, and how does this work, and that's perhaps where the guidance is missing. So if I take the Eurozone, I think that those who argue that inflation would not be compatible with considering the population of bonds issued in the Eurozone, I have difficulty with that for the reasons that Andrew expressed, that those countries are operating in somehow an integrated market with a central bank that has high power on inflation, even if you may have differences of inflation within that region. In the same way, sure, if you have differences in inflation between the West Coast and the East Coast or whatever. So, but still, you are not arguing that the assumptions are not mutually compatible.
That's right.
So it's perhaps, you know, that link that is missing and could address the fact I don't know Panama sufficiently, but to say that looking at inflation for U.S. bonds and so on, and discount rate just on the U.S. bonds would not be mutually compatible with inflation you notice in Panama and so on.
I think, as John pointed out to us, and he's pushed his button again, we didn't go there. We said that we said that all we could do in an annual improvement was say currency matters, but we couldn't go to discount rates because we've already broken our pick on that one.
So my recommendation is just that when you present the issue to the RESB, you need to bring that light about the mutually compatible assumptions so that then they can see and decide whether they want to proceed further.
That's fair. John?
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand it with a country who denominates its obligations in US dollars but has a very high inflation rate, why we would think that the inflation rate for that country is going to be what the obligation is, how the obligations are ultimately going to be. I mean, if that's the case, I want to be in that place because I have a US dollar entitlement that's actually going to be inflated at an inflation rate that has nothing to do with US dollars. So to me, the assumptions, the inflation rate assumptions are going to be relevant to the obligation that you've got, which is a US dollar obligation. So it seems to me that it's not, you know, talking about a disconnect between the country's inflation rate and the currency of the obligation, it's not, you know, the inflation assumptions have to be relevant to the obligation and the currency that obligation is denominated in.
So. Yeah, this gets to more macroeconomics than I'm competent in, but my understanding was that countries peg themselves or adopt something like the US dollar in an attempt to force control on local inflation. And some countries have said, well, that didn't work, so they abandoned it and redenominated their pension obligations into a local currency, which worked out not so well for the pension holders. So, not I was thinking of Antarctica myself, but anyway, all right, we will inform the board, but then you've got some more questions, assuming that the committee does decide to go ahead, which it just did. So,
if the committee agree with the transition provision, we are recommending a prospective application from the beginning of the ELIS comparative period presented.
Perspective that the change in rates will be treated as an actuarial assumption, a change in assumption. No restatement as of first of.
No restatement, but will be prospective from the beginning of the earliest period presented.
With the catch up? Where the question?
Earliest period presented.
In the opening,
yeah. No. Prospect would still be 1st of January in the earliest period presented, not opening retained earnings.
So where will the
first
in
of January.
Income statement
as well. Income statement. Yeah. Mm. In that period.
Well,
Measurement. We are in IAS 19. When we usually say the beginning, which means that the adjustment goes to retained earnings, I thought. Michael said income statement.
Maybe I just read it. I thought that's what was happening here.
We need to be clear. It's kind of a big deal.
I thought we were basically saying redo the DDO with the new discount rate as of the beginning of the earliest period presented, and then run it through. If we're doing it prospective from that first period, then I guess the initial change in the estimate of the discount rates would go to OCI.
Now let's clarify right now. How many prefer it to be prospective from the beginning of the first period, which means that the adjustment goes to retained earnings?
That would be a
cumulative catch-up.
I would describe that as retrospective. Can we ask where people want the adjustment to go? Is it opening retained earnings or is it current period performance, whether that's P&L or OCI according to what IAS 19 requires?
And for retained earnings.
Retained earnings.
Unless there's some reason it can't be done that way.
Yes. Retained earnings.
Retained earnings.
I will teach people to not read the transition closer.
Okay, having solved that, or at least answered it,
finished.
Is that all?
Yes.
Approval to go forward to the board with this one, with a whole bunch of explanatory matter, but not waiting for an effects analysis.
Okay.
Okay? All right. For the people in the audience and the people on the phone, we have a presentation.
We do. So in recognition of our departing committee members, now there have been some cards being passed around for signing.
Oh, we know you better than that.
We can maybe sort of catch up with the signing afterwards, but we just want to say thank you very much to our three retiring members, so Luca, John and Scott, and thank you very much for all that you've contributed over these last 6 years. We recognise that it's a big commitment being members of the Interpretations Committee in terms of the amount of time and focus that you're required and expected to apply to this, and we see that you do that because we see your contributions both in the meetings but also from time to time when we ask for sort of contributions offline and helping staff with developing proposals or working on wording, and so your contributions really are appreciated. So it's sad to see you go, but times change and things move on. We've got some frames here that just sort of recognise the achievements of the Interpretations Committee during your membership of it. So maybe if I could ask, first of all, Luca, perhaps to come up and present you with yours.
We should also say that all of what he said is true of Joanna Perry, but she's not actually leaving. She's going through a lateral move. So.
Thanks.
And Sean?